Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to Plains Art Museum on this beautiful night, beautiful spring night. We have the pleasure of having Cecilia Fire Thunder, one of our artists from Washamo Bajazi, which means it translates to power lines. And one of the biggest power lines that I know of is Miss Cecilia, who whose name Fire Thunder fits her perfectly. She's from Pine Ridge Reservation. She's an activist, feminist, and a go-getter. She does a lot of work for females and for human beings. And we were worried she wasn't going to get here in time, but she got here in time, and we're so excited to have her here. I'd like to, if you would please help me welcome Cecilia Fire Thunder.
Thank you, Wapila. Thank you very much. You know, I have a red charger sitting out there. At my age, I like to rent bright cars. One time I even rented a yellow Mustang convertible cruising around Santa Fe. So as we get older, we get to do things, right? What do you think, huh? First of all, let me greet you in my first language. My relative, So I want to greet you with a warm handshake, with good feelings from my heart, and share some things with you to make you feel better. You know, being a woman is a big challenge in our world, is it not? You can have 40 PhDs, but you're still not going to make as much money as a guy with one PhD, right? So one of the hardest things for women, especially women of color, over the years, is to really understand the condition of women, all women's lives. And it's so much easier when we begin to understand that we're all in the same predicament. One of the challenges that I face every day is that women of color in America still are treated very badly. And I'm sure Jesus Christ is sitting up there crying, right? So, you know, we have all kinds of crazy stories about stuff like that, you know. And I always remember a story when the governor of South Dakota, Mickelson, remember, you've heard of Mickelson, he was the governor, he got killed in a plane crash. Governor Mickelson wanted to have a dialogue across the whole state and try to understand what we can do to have better relationships with each other as cowboys and Indians, as white people and Indians. So he started a conversation to start taking a look at what happened that created this divide. And I can remember a couple of, I just sat and listened a few times. Anyway, he before he got his dream off the ground, he died and never went any further after the governor died. I gave testimony in a committee for the state. And I can recall the lady, and as the hearing came to a conclusion, the lady asked me what my thoughts were on race relations. So I told her, do you go to church every Sunday? She said, oh, yes, I do. How many of you go to church every Sunday? They all raised their hand. I said, and you go to church and you ask for guidance and you ask for help to be a good human being. And part of asking for help to be a good human being is to treat all people in a good way, right? They go, yeah. So every Sunday morning, you've got the whole state of South Dakota in church praying to be good human beings. And within 1 hour, they're still back to hating, you know. So I guess my answer is if God can't make us get along, I don't think any law is going to make us get along, you know. So anyway, I'm 72 years of age, and I've been doing a lot of writing, Verlaine. I've been doing a lot of writing to really get a sense of where I've been, what happened that brought me here today to Fargo, North Dakota, my first time ever in Fargo, North Dakota. And it's important that we go back and take a look at our lives. How many of you know that? Assess our lives. Look at all of the bumps that we had to go through. Because obviously the bump wasn't hard enough to knock you on your ass. You picked yourself back up. Did you not? Yes. Yes. And yeah, you pick yourself back up and you keep going. I think every woman needs to write her story for no other reason than for your great-granddaughters to read it, to know who you are and what you did. So stop a minute. So one of the things is that I worked with Verlaine for years in domestic violence, and then one day I said, I can't do this anymore. So I left and I started working with the Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Association as a health policy analyst and working on legislation. When I turned 65, I said to my boss, you better riff me. She said, what? I said, riff me. Why? He says, I have other things to do. And collect unemployment. How many of you know how hard it is to collect unemployment? Good Lord, you got to go face to face, right? On the Pine Ridge Reservation, it's like out in the boonies. And so I said, forget this. There's a young woman that I worked with. The other thing I need you to know is all the women I work with are half my age. Most women my age are dead, okay? Or they're not in good shape, right? And especially for my reservation, you have diabetes, and you people lose their legs and their eyes, you know. I always joke about it, but I shouldn't. But most women my age are not alive. How many of you know that? We don't get to this age. So I'm very fortunate. I'm 72. I don't have high blood pressure. I don't have diabetes. There's really nothing wrong with me. And my medication of choice is Jameson whiskey. No. Takes care of everything. Well, anyway, so there's a young woman I worked with for years doing education stuff, taking her to D.C., and I take young women and show them how to work the Hill, how to talk to a senator, how to talk to congressmen. Anyway, she calls me. She said, what are you doing Thursday? I said, what time? She said, 1 o'clock. I said, come on over, she said. So I went to the Porcupine College Center. How many of you know there's 9 college centers on Pine Ridge? We have 9 college centers on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Every community has a college center. We run the center in Rapid City, and we also run the college at Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. So we've got 11 sites. So anyway, I went in, and she said, you're going to take a test. I said, I am? She said, yeah. It's called the OPI, Oral Proficiency Interview. So I sat down with some elder Lakota speakers, and they tested me. And they wanted to measure my level of fluency and reading in Lakota. So you need to know, Lakota is my first language. I didn't speak English till I was 5 years of age. Then I went to Catholic boarding school, and the first thing I learned how to do was say, Our Father who art in heaven. Hail Mary, full of grace. So Lakota was always my first language. So I sat down with these elders, Lakota speakers, and they tested me in many ways. So after they tested me, they gave me this one sheet of paper that was a Lakota language written maybe 80 years ago. They wanted me to read it and translate it, so I did. Not completely, but the gist of what the message was. I passed it. So they said, all right, you passed it. So I took my, fancy names, linguistics, what's the other one, methods, all those things you have to take. So today I am a certified Lakota language teacher for Lakota College. And guess what? I've been teaching 300 level classes. I ended up being a professor. How about that? And then I've been teaching a 600 graduate course. And the realization is that you don't need a piece of paper or some symbols behind you. How many of you are born smart like me? Let me see your hands. One more time. How many of you are born smart? Yes. The difference, so being smart is in your DNA. Having an education is what we do at these colleges, right? You read, write, do research, whatever. So being smart is a given. It's in your DNA. So one of the things that I discovered over time was I'm smart. How many of you say that? I'm smart. I know how to figure things out. I can look at a problem, and I know how to figure out what to do with it. Where did that come from? It came from your ancestors who long time ago did not have everything you had. They didn't have Google, right? You had to figure it out yourself, right? Yeah, how to fix things, how to repair things. Somebody said, God, you're really smart. I know. I said, I have a PhD. Really? From where? Google University. Everything I need to know, I just can turn on Google, and there it is, right? YouTube, anything you need to know. So, anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. You know, one of the other parts of who we are is our creative side. Left brain, right? And too often, we have to just keep using one side to survive, go to work, get a paycheck, buy food, and take care of your family. So who has time to be creative? Do you understand what I'm saying? You know? And so the other thing is redefine creativity. How do we redefine it so that it fits our life? So I'm looking at all this stuff at this time of my life and how I was able to come to where I am today. I grew up on an Indian reservation. 1946 I was born. Probably some of you weren't even thought of in 1946, right? Yeah. And I was one of the fortunate people who was born at home with a midwife. And all the ceremonies that needed to be done were done to give me a real strong sense of belonging. How many of you know what that word means? To belong. It's a powerful sense. So today, as I was looking back at my life and all those things, I'm really grateful that despite all of the things that were going on in the 40s, being put on a reservation, being limited to what my ancestors could do to go hunting, and having to live under BIA laws and rules. So when you take a look at that time, it was not a good time. There was a lot of control. You know, in one of my classes, I teach American Indian psychology. There's a word called acculturation. How many of you know that word? Acculturation. So my students are learning these words. Acculturation is when you learn two cultures. Your culture, then you learn another culture. So as a Lakota girl, I learned to speak English. True? Huh? Yeah. So I had to learn the rules of the white people in my neighborhood. Yeah. And included in there was had to accept Jesus Christ, right? So in 1819, the Civilization Act was passed. How many of you know about that? 1819, Civilization Act was passed. And that was the first time the United States government gave money to educate Indians. This funding was given to benevolent societies, which means what? Yeah, churches. And they were directed to civilize us Indians. To civilize us, we had to learn to speak their language and accept Jesus Christ and be Christians. And that was the rule. So if you take a look at the history of boarding school, if you take a look at all of those things, that was done in a way that terrorized and traumatized little kids in Indian country. So today we're seeing more and more stories emerging that people are talking about that impact that it had. So one of the things is, so here it is. So behind me, from 1880 to 2019, about 140 years of assimilation, colonialism, whatever. So I look back to 140 years of all the things that were done to me as a Lakota woman. And then I stop. And then I need to look forward to the next 140 years to celebrate what we still have. No longer blame, no longer talk about historical trauma. To celebrate that we're still here. To celebrate for me, so I, as one Lakota woman, despite 140 years of systematic ways to get rid of us, I'm still here, damn it. Is that cool or what? I am still here. I still speak my language. I still live on my land. Yeah? Okay? So what I have been doing for me is to understand, to let go of the past and celebrate it and capture what we still have to move forward and bring our little children along with us. As we're more and more, we're teaching our language in our classroom. We've got all these creative ways of teaching Lakota. You have immersion. My favorite one is TPR. How many of you know what TPR is? Total physical response. No reading or writing until the third or fourth grade. That's how many of you speak. That's how I learned to speak Lakota. No reading or writing. Senses. See, hear, feel. Right? So what? So I'm a real proponent of TPR, and so I'm rather having issues with some of our language teachers. Anyway, no reading or writing. So we're learning to understand methods, different ways of doing things. So today I'm here as an artist, and I never considered myself an artist. I just did things, and I made things. How many of you sew? How many of you get pleasure out of sewing? How many of you just cutting, putting it together, sitting at the sewing machine, putting it together, ironing it? Oh, wow, look at this, huh? Yeah, yeah. And so much that I didn't realize that I was learning. So growing up on the Pine Ridge as a little girl, of course, there was no Walmart. There was no Target. There was no fabric stores. My mother used to drag us with her to all the rummage sales. Of course, all the nice, benevolent Catholic ladies in the United States would send boxes of clothes to the church, right? So we would go to the church and go through all the boxes. But this is what I learned. My mother would say to us, look for plaid, look for cotton. So we'd be rummaging, looking for dresses made out of plaid and cotton, right? We gather those, and then we would get denim. Denim. How many of you have ever had a denim quilt? Let me see your hands. Those damn things were heavy, right? Woo-hoo-hoo! So in the middle of winter in North Dakota, you lay down and they put a denim quilt on. You better pee before you go to bed. So those denim quilts were made specifically for cold winter nights in North Dakota and South Dakota, right? So we used to look for stuff, and she'd come home, wash it, tear it apart, and guess what? We had yards of denim, yards of plaid, yards of cotton. She would take these pieces and make us dresses, and she did it all by hand. Mm-hmm. She would look at you, and she'd sketch it out on a, remember those brown paper bags, split it open? And she made patterns. And my mother only went to the fourth grade. So what that taught me was to always look for material. So the dolls, the wool dresses, they're made out of navy bell bottoms. I lived in San Diego from 1976 to 1988. And on my days off, I would go to all the thrift stores in San Diego. What did I look for? Navy bell bottoms, because it's 100% wool. How many of you know that? Before they started doing the polyester stuff, right? So they were 100% wool, and then they had all those buttons, remember? I laugh about that. Poor guy, he was just horny. He couldn't get those buttons off fast enough. That's lady humor, right? Anyway, so I accumulated a big jar of the buttons. Anyway, even that Navy, remember they had that little flap? Well, when I tear that apart, that was just enough for a doll dress. So I would go. So today I still have Navy bell bottoms for special dolls that I make. So even though I had an income and even though I could go buy fabric, I still go to thrift stores. How about you? And how about you look through fabric and if you can find something to come home and tear it apart, use it to make something, huh? So that was so being creative, the creativity of doing things without having a lot. What's the value in that? Help me out here. Come on. What? Ingenuity. What else? Huh? Okay. What else? Okay. And even just to know there's stuff in that Catholic hall. But the other thing that my mother did, somebody always gave the Catholic Church in Kyle, where I lived, National Geographics. So she would bring home National Geographics. Now, how many of you remember, oh, my God, look at this place. Where is this place, you know? And so we would sit there on an Indian reservation and fantasize about going to Egypt, where the hell Egypt was, you know? And so that was the other thing I was thinking about in terms of the motivation and just the visuals of looking at National Geographic and looking at all these wonderful places somewhere in the world, and that could be a little trigger to say, one day I'm going to go there. How many of you had that aha moment? And how many of you still have a list that you need to go? Well, anyway, so I'm going to Machu Picchu. Finally. I told my friends, we got to go while we can still walk, ladies. One day we'll walk earth and crutches. We're not going to be able to go, you know. So we're going to Machu Picchu for no other reason. And it's been hanging somewhere in my home office, a picture of Machu Picchu. Amazing place. So I did all this research on the people of that region. And one of the things that I discovered was that all Indians... How many of you were not created out of Adam's rib besides me? One more time. How many of you were not created out of Adam's rib, damn it? Ah! I actually did a term paper on that. You too? Yeah. So anyway, one of the beauties of being a teacher is that I get to do a lot of research. So Lakota people, my people, our creation story is that we emerged out of the wind cave. So it was the emergence. So there's all over the United States where indigenous people live, from the tip of Alaska all the way to the tip of South America. Every indigenous group has a story of how they came to be. How many of you know that? So anyway, so Lakota people, we were emergence. We came out this way to the wind cave. And it was a woman that made it happen, darn it. And then along with the woman, the other really important four-legged was the buffalo. The buffalo was a very important component of that emergence and coming to the surface. So I discovered, how many of you ever heard of Lake Titicaca? That's where they emerged, out in the middle of that lake. It's an island. They emerged from there. So anyway, I was doing all this research. So I just want to go there before I die. And that's on my list. It's going to happen, I think, in 6 months. So let's stop a minute. So what I did was, how many of you make things to relax? How many of you make things to calm yourself down? How many of you make things and you're crying as you're making it, huh? Yes. So part of being creative is about healing. So what I discovered, so I went to Los Angeles in 1963 on a relocation program. The relocation program was the Truman administration to assimilate Indians to get rid of us and put us in large cities, Cleveland, San Francisco, Denver, LA, under the guise of employment. His hope was that we were going to move to these big cities and disappear. So that was called assimilation. So in 1963, my dad and my mom and five of us girls, I was the oldest at that time, went to LA on relocation. The interesting thing about that was that my dad was a hard worker. He was always a hard worker. How many of you love and idolize your dad? How many of you had a good dad? How many of you had a dad that loved you, hugged you, told you you were cute, beautiful, huh? Yeah. Anyway, so he was a cowboy. I love cowboys. Damn it, damn it, damn it. I just love the Indian cowboys. Anyway, so my dad and my uncles all had cattle, and well, there's a policy. That's another story. The policies on trying to make us be self-sufficient, they had too many rules, and consequently the rules to be self-sufficient were so, it didn't work. I saw Paul Robertson at the airport. He was just flying in. I was flying out. Paul Robertson wrote a book with his PhD thesis, and what he wrote about was from the beginning of the reservation era to today. And he talked about the policies that were in place. Here we're supposed to teach us to be farmers and ranchers and be self-sufficient, yet all the rules that they imposed on you prevented you from being self-sufficient. Example, so if you had 8 cows that were ready for market, right down the road is Nebraska where they sell a lot of cows, right, the market. He needed to take the cows to Nebraska while the prices were up to sell them. Well, he couldn't. You know why? He needed to get the superintendent's signature. So by the time you found a damn superintendent, the sun went down and the market dropped. So that's just one example. So here they're trying to make us self-sufficient at the same time they had rules. So my dad said, heck with this. So we went to L.A. My dad was a hard worker. He got a job at a company called Wilson Bennett. And it was a union shop. How many of you know about unions? Yeah. So my dad had a really neat salary. He was getting raises. He had great health care coverage, health insurance and stuff. And he went to work every day. So he was my role model. Anyway, so one of the things, the other thing, one time he said, Lakota, I never spoke English to my dad. Hey, inskale a policy wa bluha taku he. Mat eki he u mayahok dashke. Okay. He said, I have a policy when I die, you guys don't have to pay for my funeral. My union will pay for it, you know, stuff like that. So anyway, so one of the things in Los Angeles on the relocation program was I wrote this note on a plane. In 1970, the census for Indians in LA County was about 60,000 Indians. The relocation program put Indians in LA from all over the Southwest. Montana, South Dakota. The other thing was the railroad, the Santa Fe Railroad, came from the Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona, into L.A. And who worked on the Santa Fe Railroads? Majority of them were Pueblo Indians and Navajos worked the railroad, Santa Fe. Santa Fe, Santa Fe Railroad Company had its own hospital in Los Angeles to provide health care services to its employees. They had babies there, they had surgeries there. So the Santa Fe Railroad Company was a large conglomerate, and they provided good health care benefits to its people. So a lot of Indians from the Southwest lived all along that railroad line coming into Los Angeles. And so what I discovered later on, Los Angeles, we had so many damn Indians in L.A. Jeez! We had, of course, Lakotas, we had Navajos, we had Blackfeet, we had Anishinaabes, all kinds of Indians in L.A., right? And so they tried to put us in different parts of Los Angeles, but as Indians, we know how to find each other. Yeah, all you had to do was go like this. Hey. we knew how to find each other. And then, so before I moved from LA in 1976, we had 5 powwow groups. The Northern Plains Indians had our powwow by Griffith Park, where the big observatory is. There was a community hall there. So all the Northern Plains Indians would gather there for a powwow. We'd get 5 or 6 drums, so we were still singing and dancing. You know, how cool is that? And then invariably, we would get all these guys from Camp Pendleton, which is down the road. Somehow those Indians in Camp Pendleton heard there was a bunch of Indians dancing in L.A., so they all came up. So we would have sailors and Marines coming up to join us. So what happened was all the Indians found each other in Los Angeles. So we had our own community, huh? We had our own bowling league, our powwow league, our basketball league, our baseball league. Jeez, there was all kinds of Indians. We were just having fun, snagging each other. I always say this, is, I tell my students, I don't care how many kids you have. Make sure you marry an Indian and have a couple of Indian babies first, and then you can marry anybody you want. How many of y'all? Yeah, make sure you have a couple of Indian babies and then marry that cowboy or whatever you want, you know. So anyway, long story short, so I finished high school. I love that, don't you? I have 2 full-blooded Indian boys. And after my second baby was born, I was laying there thinking. My mother came in, Lakota. I said, she said, what are you thinking of? I ain't going to have any more kids. Good girl, she said. So I went on birth control right away. And whose permission did I need? Whose permission did I need? Mine. My body, my vagina, my uterus. Got it? It belongs to me, and I decided no more. Is that cool or what? And I stuck to it. How cool is that? I did. I had an IUD. The doctor said, I said, how does that work? So my mom looked at it. Hey, I let the sperm, we call the sperm Sue. Let's look at Yana, let go home, Nina, let go home. Hey, pretty soon it get dizzy, it fall down. So I was only going to use the lippy. I was going to use this for, so apparently you're only supposed to have it on for like 3 years, right? I had it for 8 years. Dang thing worked good. It got rid of a lot of dizzy sperm. Well, anyway, so finally the doctor said, so say, how long have you had this? I said, you should have had it taken out 5 years ago, girl. I said, what are you going to do? He said, we have to take it out. So can you rinse it off and put it back in? No, anyway, so I'm getting ahead of myself here. But is that okay? So anyway, I became, so when I lived in L.A., I met my children's father, who's from my same community. His mom had been on relocation years ago. So we got together. And my grandmother always said, Lakota, she always said, when you're going to have children, make sure he's from our tribe. Okay? So that stayed with me. So this man was from our tribe. So anyway, I married him, had 2 sons, and it didn't go very well. So next thing I know, I'm a mother on welfare with 2.0 children with no skills. My social worker, who was a Japanese woman, she said, Cecilia, you're really smart. I said, am I? She said, come on, let me give you a test. So she gave me a test. Jeez, look at this. What do you want to do? I said, well, I think I want to be a nurse. So she got me in touch with all these people. Next thing I know, I got accepted to do nursing programs. And I passed it, took my state boards, and I had an income. So I wasn't on welfare anymore. Darn it, no more food stamps, you know. That was the whole reason to get a skill. What I learned, ladies, what I learned in that time was there's always somebody somewhere who can help you. How many of you know that? And we should never be afraid to say what? I need some help here. Yeah? I need some help here. Because somebody will come behind you and will pick it up and it can help you. So what's the most important lesson I learned was you're not alone and there's somebody who will always help you if you ask for it. Yeah? What's the hardest thing for, how many of you have a hard time asking for help anyway? Sometimes we have to stop it, because sometimes we can't do it all by ourselves. So always good to ask for a little help, right? Say, help me, help me, help me. Anyway, so the other thing, this is a really funny story. So we started an Indian clinic. How many of you remember in the 70s, free clinics all over the United States? Los Angeles had a Chicano free clinic, they had an Asian free clinic, they had an African American free clinic, all over Los Angeles County. So Reverend Saraceno called a bunch of us Indians together and he said, hey, we have a lot of Indians that don't have health insurance here in Los Angeles. We need to find a way to provide health care to all of our people. So when you go on relocation, you don't have skills, so you get low-paying jobs. Low-paying jobs do not have health insurance. True? So the statistics were right in front of us. So we said, okay. So I volunteered to help. I worked night shifts, so my job was to talk to him. So he says to me, you know what? You really talk good English. Go talk to the Chicano Free Clinic and see if you can get some help. I said, okay. Long story short, the Chicano Free Clinic, the Asian Free Clinic, and African American Free Clinic provide us some amazing technical assistance. So we got our free clinic off the ground.
Yeah.
Off the running. And the first grant I ever wrote, how many of you remember the first grant you ever wrote? Okay, the first grant I ever wrote was for 500 disposable plastic speculums from the Los Angeles Family Planning something. So I wrote the grant for 500 speculums, small, medium, and large, right? So one day they said, Cecilia, there's a truck here delivering boxes, and it was my speculums. So that victory alone pushed me to look for other resources. I ended up being a really good resource person, finding resources, finding people and connecting people. So we opened up a free clinic on Long Beach Boulevard in Compton, California. And immediately we were busy. So many of our native people in Los Angeles County had no health care or dental care. The biggest coup I had was I was able to recruit a whole bunch of guys that belonged to a Army Reserve. This Army Reserve had pediatricians, orthopedics, the whole gamut. And they would go to different communities and provide health care. They had pharmacists, dentists. There were 36 in the team. I recruited them to come to my clinic every month. So as I was walking with this big, tall, good-looking white guy, he looked good in his uniform. He had a flat stomach, and and he smelled so good. I might have been Old Spice. Some of you like Old Spice, no matter what. So anyway, so we were walking, and he says to me, "It's Fire Thunder." I said, "Yes, sir." "Do you have a hearing problem?" I said, "I do." "How can you tell how you speak?" He was a what? Yeah. So we were visiting and talking. He said, "How long have you been hard of hearing?" I said, "My whole life." I said, "I was a little Indian girl with ear infections, and we didn't have, you know, antibiotics, and so it just got worse and worse." So he said, and we're talking, I said to him, "So how am I speaking?" He said, "It's how you say some of the words. I know you can't hear the high-pitched sound, like shh, you know, so how you pronounce your words." I said, "Dang," I said, "I got over that. I better start reading out loud again, you know." So long story short, I'm deaf. I have cochlear implants. So I always remember the day I got deaf. And how can you forget a day you got deaf? So I lost my hearing in my left ear. So I had a Mycross hearing aid, so the microphone picked up sounds over here and translated. Anyway, long story short, one day I woke up and my sister was visiting me. I said, she said, "I still can't hear. It didn't work." So we went to town and the audiologist, she said, "It's gone." I said, "Where did it go?" Well, that was in April. I had just opened up the campaign office for Senator Tim Johnson to get him back into the United States. Remember that? Tim Johnson. I just love, how many of you know Tim Johnson? For a white guy, he was okay. Yeah. Actually, our senators from South Dakota, I just love them all to death. James Abaresque, Tom Daschle, Tim Johnson, and our former Governor McGovern. So these are four former senators that I knew personally that mentored me on many things. So Tim, I opened up a campaign office to get Tim back into the United States Senate. And then 2 weeks later, I lost my hearing. However, I think I cried. I was feeling sorry for myself just for 2 days. I can't hear a damn thing, but I can still talk, right? I can't hear a damn thing, but the damn computer sitting in front of me, and I can go click, 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 right? So I started organizing Tim's re-election. In the meantime, my little sister, who works at UCLA, always knew that invariably I was going to need something. So I emailed her. I said, okay, I'm deaf now. All right. About 2 days later, she sent me a whole list of places where I could go and get an implant, a cochlear implant. So one of them was University of Iowa. And Dr. Gantz, at that point, did 600 implants. I said, a guy who did 600 implants, does he know what he's doing? I think so. So I trusted him. So I immediately started communicating with him. I had to go to the University of Iowa. I had to go through all these tests. First time I had to fail everything, okay? So in the meantime, I'm still running Tim Johnson's campaign deaf. I was still doing radio shows deaf because you can measure your voice by touching. How many of you know that? Yeah, yeah. So I had all these tricks I was using. Or I tell people, if I'm talking too loud, go like this. You can't hear me, go like this. So people were going like this. So I was training everybody how to work with me because I couldn't hear a damn thing, you know. Long story short, so on election day, I had to go to University of Iowa and get my surgery. But I left it in fine company. So this is historical. Senator John Thune was running for Tim's position, remember? So East River, which is the Missouri River, East River is one time frame away, an hour ahead. So at midnight, John Thune was celebrating victory. In the meantime, the Pine Ridge votes were just taken to be counted. At 6 o'clock next morning, Tim Johnson beat John Thune by 587 votes. And we were dancing because that was our vote. So we were out there beating the bushes to get our people registered and go vote, right? So anyway, so we got Tim back in. And then, so I went for my surgery. And my first sister went with me for the assessment. My second sister went with me. She's a nurse, to be my nurse. The amazing thing, ladies and gentlemen, is it works. So they put 23 electrodes in my cochlear. So my insurance, I was working for the Democratic Party then too. So they had Blue Cross Blue Shield. So they could pay for one side. And so Dr. Gantz sat down and he said, we would like to encourage you to take part in our long-term study. If we will pay for the other side, or you can have bilateral. I said, oh, sure, I've always wanted to be a guinea pig, you know. So long story short, I was able to get bilateral cochlear implants. So I had to go back. And so the audiologist, I got all the research, and she says, I'm going to put this on, and I'm going to turn it on. And then I'm going to say, can you hear me? 1, 2, 3. I said, okay. Well, how many of you always feel like something's not going to work? So I had this, oh, it's not going to work, okay? So she hooked me all up, and then she said, click. She said, can you hear me? So if you lost your hearing, what would be the one sound you would miss the most? Laughing? Okay. What's underwater? Huh? Breathe. Only in North Dakota. Okay. You can't hear in your children. Yeah, what about you? Kids playing. Anybody else? What would you miss the most? Okay. Birds.